On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Michael Flannery, author of Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life.
This idea about competition and how competition occurs and how it affects the evolutionary process seems to be really at the core of what this theory turns into. So can you come back and in layman's terms explain the differences between Darwin's view of competition and Wallace's view of competition?
Wallace tended to view competition occurring among groups in a demographic sense. Darwin tended to view it as individual competition.
We're hitting the note of some themes that come up over and over again. Class, collectivism versus individualism and all that. But to me, it seems obvious that Wallace was right. I mean, the competition for the food supply in terms of what would make a certain species go extinct is primarily a group, collective kind of thing. That just seems to ring true to me.
Right. But see, it's an expression of how they collected. Think of how Darwin, remember I said Darwin collected individual species. He would examine them in great, great detail. Maybe just a few different species. Whereas Wallace was collecting huge numbers, 125,000 species. He's collecting demographically.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, our guest Mike Flannery is going to talk about the theory of evolution back from its very origins, the days of Charles Darwin, and in particular, Alfred Russel Wallace. You know, one of the reasons I found this topic so interesting is that one of the threads that reoccurs over and over in Skeptico is the nature of the deception, if you will. That is, the deception that so much of science has become. And it's interesting to trace back that deception all the way back to the 1850s and to gain an insight into how this discovery, the theory of evolution, has deep implications for science and for so many of the topics we talk about. Here's my interview with Mike Flannery. Today we welcome Michael Flannery to Skeptico. Professor Flannery is Associate Director for Historical Collections at the Lister Hill Library at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He's here to talk with us about evolution, Darwinism, and his book, Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life. Professor Flannery, thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, as I was just mentioning before, I really have enjoyed learning about some of the wonderful things you've discovered about Alfred Russel Wallace. The breadth of your knowledge is really impressive. And I was particularly drawn to, I have to say, some of the critiques and reviews you've written on Amazon to many of the books that have been published in this area. And you've done a great service to all of us there just in helping sort out this very complicated and interesting part of history. So thanks for that.
Well, thanks, Alex.
But I have to start with the real question that we all want to know, Mike, and that's, how do you think Noah got all those dinosaurs on the boat? You know, I'm kidding, obviously, you know, but I feel like I have to start there. And it's frustrating because I've listened in researching the show. I've listened to so many really smart scientists, you know, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson and Dawkins and all these other ones. And yet they beat this crazy creationist scare tactic thing to death. And so as I ask that question kind of tongue in cheek, I also want to slip in the real question. And that's, do you think the situation would be different? Would I still be asking that ridiculous question if Alfred Russel Wallace's ideas about evolution had won out?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think, you know, the obvious short answer is no. You know, Wallace had his own view. I guess it might be helpful for your audience to sort of step back and sort of review what Alfred Russel Wallace really did, because certainly by comparison to Charles Darwin, he is more or less the unknown entity. So let me just start off by saying that Alfred Russel Wallace was the co-discoverer of natural selection. So he was, you know, very much involved with the early thinking along the lines of evolutionary theory. In fact, he's the one that actually finally prompted Charles Darwin to rush his work to press after Darwin received his letter from the Spice Islands. He was all the way in the Malay Archipelago on the Ternate Island and sent him this letter that really laid out a theory of natural selection. However, Alfred Russel Wallace diverged or departed from Darwin's theory in proposing what I have referred to as intelligent evolution, which is actually directed, detectably designed, and purposeful common descent. In other words, there was teleology involved in certain aspects of evolution.
Now, hold on right there, because I think this is obviously there's all these landmines in this discussion, and you've just stepped on one of them, and that's intelligence, and then you want to throw design anywhere close to that other word, and we have this other thing. So I want to, if I can, kind of put a pause on that for a second and talk about history, because you really deconstruct this history so beautifully, and it's a complex history, and it's been made even more complex with some of the recent books that have been come out and have revealed this deep conspiracy about Darwin and all that, some of which I think have merit. So let me, if I can, put a pause button on that, and I want you to elaborate on a scene that you just sketched out there a minute ago. It's 1858. Charles Darwin receives this paper from Alfred Russel Wallace, and it's one colleague, one scientist to another, seeking assistance. Can you flesh out what's going on there in 1958 with this letter from Russell to Darwin?
Yeah, in 1858, in fact, in February of 1858, Wallace is suffering from a malarial fever. There's only two things that would give a naturalist like Wallace time to speculate and theorize: either bad weather or bad health. And in this case, he had bad health. He was suffering from malarial fever, and he pauses to sketch out this theory of natural selection. Now he sends it. It's commonly known by historians simply as the Ternate Letter. It was actually headed with the title "On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from Their Original Type." So it's not exactly a title that rolls off the tongue. So, you know, oftentimes historians will just refer to it as the Ternate Letter. Well, Darwin had been working on a theory of natural selection for some time. He had an approximately 230-page draft, the famous 1844 sketch, that he had been working on and had been keeping under wraps. He hadn't really done anything with it. The only people who really knew about this was Emma, his wife, and his two closest confidants, Charles Lyell and Joseph Dalton Hooker. Now, he gets this letter. You have to remember, Darwin has been working on some form of what was called then transmutation, what we would call today as evolutionary theory. It was all kept up under wraps. He had discussed it with close friends and confidants, but not much more than that. And he gets this letter from Wallace, and he says he gets it on June 18th, 1858. That's when he's, according to his diary, he receives the Ternate Letter, and he is astonished. He realizes that what he has in his hand is essentially a theory that would form the drivetrain of evolutionary theory, and he realizes if he doesn't do something he's going to be scooped.
Now, scooped matters. It matters a lot, right?
Sure. And science, you know, the first is everything very often. And so he's very concerned about that. Now, he gathers together, he calls together Lyell and Hooker, as you would expect. You know, I would do the same thing. I'd call my closest confidants and say, what do? I got this letter. Well, Hooker and Lyell say, look, we're all members of the Linnaean Society. Linnaean Society was one of the most preeminent scientific societies in London at the time. What we'll do is we'll rush at the very next Linnaean Society meeting. We're going to put a program together, and we are going to unveil your theory along with Wallace's. So, modern evolutionary theory by natural selection is unveiled to the world at a Linnaean Society meeting on July 1st, 1858. And here's how it goes down. The very first thing that is read that evening is portions of Darwin's 1844 sketch. Then an 1857 letter between Darwin and Asa Gray, the famous American naturalist, is read, in which some more of his theory is sort of developed. And then at the end of a long evening to what must have been a bleary-eyed and, by the way, poorly attended audience, they have the Ternate letter read. So, in effect, the idea at this meeting was to make it very clear that priority belonged to Darwin. But they did not, you know, to their credit, you know, keep Wallace's letter under wraps. They unveiled it to the public, and so both Wallace and Darwin became known as the more or less the co-discoverers of natural selection, although Darwin at that point, of course, realized that he didn't have a lot of time to simply, you know, sort of sit on and rest on his laurels. He had to get the rest of his theory out and out in a hurry. So he pretty much got his notes together and then rushed to press on The Origin of Species, which came out in November of 1859.
Great. Now, let me just interject there and correct me if I'm wrong, but they go on to be publicly recognized as the co-discoverers, if you will, of evolution for really the next 100 years, at least, more or less, right? So school.
Oh, yeah.
So it's only recently that we've kind of attributed evolution and attached Darwin solely to it. When did that change kind of happen?
I suppose it really happened with the neo-Darwinian synthesis in the 1930s, when basically Darwin's theory became synonymous with the theory of evolution. What I think is even more problematic is you know, Darwin's theory of evolution became synonymous with science itself.
Exactly.
And so, you know, there's a lot of conflations that go on here. But certainly, at least in the immediate sense, certainly for the generation who knew both Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, they clearly understood this and very often referred to it as the Darwin-Wallace theory.
So, and that's actually kind of a little bit of an aside, because as you so astutely point out in some of your writings, to make too big of a deal of this academic one-upsmanship in terms of whose name is on top of the paper really sidetracks us from the important differences between Darwin's view of evolution and Wallace's view. So that's where I'd like to kind of bring us next. And I'd like to talk particularly about this survival of the fittest, which becomes associated with Darwin's idea versus Wallace's idea of the survival of all but the least fit.
When you look at the dividing lines and you start looking at Charles Darwin's theory, Charles Darwin was, and I think this is sort of a key ingredient to understanding Darwin's theory, Darwin's theory was really a mechanism, I think, a mechanism that really was designed to support and explicate naturalism, more specifically, methodological naturalism. And the idea that a scientist must invoke only natural processes functioning via unbroken natural laws in non-purposeful ways.
So are you saying he started with naturalism and then looked for the mechanism to explain our world from a naturalistic viewpoint?
I believe he did. I believe he did because he had already been introduced to materialism as a philosophy as a 17-year-old member of the Plinian Society at the University of Edinburgh. He knew William Brown, William Greig. He became a close companion and confidant of Robert Edmund Grant, who was, I believe, 16 years his senior, but was a thoroughgoing evolutionist and a thoroughgoing materialist.
Hold on, because this is really an interesting point, and it's one of these subtle points that a lot of people are going to miss, because the traditional, if you will, storybook story on Darwin is, hey, he's this good Christian guy who's kind of marching along with everyone else, who is then overwhelmed by the evidence that he receives on the Galapagos Islands, and he has this aha moment, and he says, oh my gosh, as hard as it is for me to accept this as a scientist, this must be really the way that we all came to be.
Well, and Alex, I can understand why people believe that, because that's essentially what Darwin wanted us to believe in his autobiography. That's exactly the way Darwin sketches out how he came to his own theory of evolution. However, when you start digging and start looking into his life, you find out that that doesn't quite match up with his own autobiographical statements. And in fact, when we talk about Robert Edmund Grant, you know, Desmond and Moore did what I think is a very good biography on Charles Darwin, came out in the 90s, Adrian Desmond and James Moore. And you know, they're in effect more or less supporters of Darwin. So, I mean, you know, they don't have an axe to grind. But they make this interesting comment. I think it's very important to understand this. They refer to Charles Darwin and Robert Edmund Grant's meeting as decisive. They say Darwin was coming under the wing of an uncompromising evolutionist. Nothing was sacred for Grant. He saw no spiritual power behind nature's throne. The origin and evolution of life were due simply to physical and chemical forces all obeying natural laws. Now, this is the person that the young teenage Charles Darwin would go on quiet personal strolls with through the countryside.
This is amazing because it just mirrors so many of the modern day kind of cases that we hear about where someone has a particular belief and it's shaped at an early age when they first go to college and they come under the influence of a professor and that then shapes them. And then until they die, you know, they hold on to some certain idea. I just think that's such a fascinating sketch portrait that you draw there.
Well, I'm pretty convinced that's what happened. And now I'm not suggesting at this point that Charles Darwin was in any sense, let's say, an evolutionist per se at this point. What I'm saying is he had acquired a template through which he would look at the world around him. So from the moment he stepped on the HMS Beagle, you know, where he made his 5-year round the world voyage in which he was amassing all his data, he already had that materialistic template in place.
And what about Wallace? How does his worldview match that?
Well, it's different. It's very different. And in fact, Wallace, you have to understand something about Wallace and Darwin when you look at them as historic figures. Charles Darwin was pretty much a made man. I mean, he was wealthy. He came from a family of doctors. His father, Robert Darwin, had been a very successful physician, and his grandfather before him, Erasmus Darwin, who, by the way, wrote one of the early transmutationist texts called Zoonomia, which came out in 1794, which, by the way, Charles Darwin read avidly and took notes on, was also a physician. And so Darwin really never had to work. Now, that's neither here nor there, but it actually does come into play as to how they developed their evolutionary theories. At any rate, Darwin did not have to struggle for an existence. He didn't have to make a living per se. He had good investments. He was, a member of the upper classes of Victorian society, and so most of what he did, admittedly, he engaged in it with a passion, but it was, by comparison to Wallace, a hobby. What Wallace did, Wallace came from a different side of the track. He came from a struggling, I won't say he came from a poor family, but he came from a family that was in what we might call middle class decline. He had no formal education other than attending the Mechanics Institute of London for a while, in stark contrast to Darwin's Cambridge University. He spent some time as a land surveyor with his brother, but then gets a botany field manual and is absolutely captivated by nature. And so he becomes this self-taught botanist and then zoologist. And he decides to go off with Walter Henry Bates, a friend of his, off to the Amazon. And he spends 4 years in the Amazon from 1848 to 1852, comes back, he has a terrible experience there. His ship sinks, it catches on fire, and he's at sea for about 10 days before he's picked up, and loses all of his specimens and everything, so he never really completes his work, and he winds up looking for another place to go. He then spends 8 years in the Malay Archipelago from 1854 to 1862. So all this to say, the field experience of these two naturalists is also very different. Darwin, you have 5 years on the HMS Beagle, 1831 to 1836. Wallace, you've got 12 years of field experience, 4 years in South America, in the Amazon River Basin, in the Rio Negro, and the Wabash River Valley, and 8 years in the Malay Archipelago, where he goes across scores and scores of islands in that island chain. So,
why do you think that's important, Mike? What can you put your finger on where you see where that crops up in terms of?
Well, there's a couple of things. It made their collecting very different. When Darwin collected, you have to realize, what's Darwin doing? He's basically skirting the coast with Captain Fitzroy, okay? And he has time at leisure to examine individual species at great length. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But he is under no specific pressure to amass or accumulate large numbers of specimens. Wallace did, and the reason Wallace did was he was sending those back through an agent in London and selling them. This was how he was making his living. So if he didn't amass enough specimens to return, he wasn't going to put any food on the table, mm-hmm. or he wasn't going to have any income. It also forced him to collect twice. He had to collect once for himself and once for his agent in London. Okay? So by the time he gets done, he amasses over 125,000 specimens. Darwin doesn't amass anything like that. So what I'm saying is this actually affected, in a sense, how their theories differed. In some ways, you know, I've always argued that, you know, there are some people that want to suggest that Darwin stole Wallace's theory. My problem with that theory is you have to assume, if it's going to be real plagiarism, genuine theft, that the theories are identical, and they're not. if you really look at their theories, they're different. I mean, it's true. Both of their theories were, you know, principles based upon constantly changing environments, along with very small variations that affected individual survival in response to environmental pressures that would result in differential death rates, and then species held a tendency to form new perpetuating varieties. In that sense, they're the same. However, Darwin and Wallace read Malthus differently. Darwin considered the food supply had to be, on average, constant with the increase of population geometric, and Wallace saw the growth or depletion of a population due to available food and the ability of a given species to exploit it. So in other words, Darwin saw competition as taking place between individuals, while Wallace saw competition as taking place between populations.
Really, really important difference, and we're going to have to draw that out. But let me back you up a little bit and kind of come a little bit more big picture, and that's that we have Darwin here, and you make a very interesting case for the fact that Darwin was a materialist going into it. He had naturalism roots, and he was looking for a mechanism to establish that.
Right.
Wallace doesn't have that preconceived notion. Where does, before we get into the detail of the population thing and the food supply thing, which is really interesting, where is Wallace coming from? Where are his roots?
Well, ideologically, he gets introduced to some pretty radical ideas, because remember, when he's in London, he actually spent some time in London at the Mechanics Institute of London. He gets influenced by some radical ideas, like by Robert Owen and some of those individuals. And so he has some rather unorthodox sort of worker-centered ideas. And the way this actually plays out ideologically, it's a point I want to get to back to in contrasting Darwin's travel experiences with Wallace's. I already said that their collecting experiences were different, but there's another very important aspect of this which I think relates to what their theories would become. If you recall, in Darwin's narrative account of his travels on the Beagle, he meets the natives of Tierra del Fuego, the Fuegan Indians, and he's absolutely aghast. These people are like beasts, he says, you know. And he really has a tendency to view the indigenous peoples that he encounters on some sort of benchmark based upon what a good, prim, and proper Victorian would be. And so he has a tendency to view some of these people as almost beast-like. See, Wallace doesn't do this. Wallace actually lives with the people. He doesn't just see them and skirt the coast. I mean, he goes into the interior, and he lives in the interior of the Amazon River Basin. He goes into the interior of these islands in the Malay Archipelago. He lives for a while with headhunters of Borneo, for example. And he realizes that these native people have all the innate and inherent traits and abilities of any human being. Now, we take that for granted, I guess, in our 21st century sensibilities, but that was not the case in Victorian society.
And it sounds like maybe that wasn't the case for Darwin completely.
I don't think it was. Wallace viewed these people as having innate human attributes. They had the special attributes that make all humans human and unique. Abstract reasoning, a love of music, love of dance, wit. In fact, he makes a comment at one point that he actually more or less felt safer amongst the Dyak headhunters than he did in London.
Did Darwin see the natives as maybe somewhere along this, at a different point along this evolutionary path than he was at?
I don't think he comes out, or he suggests that, let me put it that way. He suggests that. Now, I'm not saying, if people are going to say, oh, you've twisted what Darwin has said, he didn't think that
animals. No, right. You're just right. But I see where you're going with that. It's interesting. It really, I mean, if I can take a little aside here, let's get real. I mean, this is 1958. We can't really blame him if he did. He didn't have the
right
benefit of everything that we know, and he didn't have our sensibilities. So
right.
I'm just asking
right
your read of it.
And actually, my read of it is that Wallace's view of Native people was actually unique. It was actually unique for his time. And in some ways, very progressive and ahead of its time. Whereas Darwin, I think, is more reflective of his generation and certainly of his class. But to carry the story a little bit further and to get to where the real demarcation comes, if I may, the real split between Wallace and Darwin occurs later. It occurs 10 years after Origin of Species is published in 1859. It's published in the Quarterly Review, in the April issue of the Quarterly Review, in 1869. And in a review of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, he ends his review by saying, and this is a paraphrase, but something to the effect that, in effect, the human beings, man, the special attributes and properties of the human mind can only be explained by calling upon an overruling intelligence. And that's the actual phrase that he uses, an overruling intelligence. Well, when Darwin reads that, he's aghast, and he scrolls a big no in the margin of his copy of the Quarterly Review and shoots off a letter to Wallace saying, "I can't believe this is coming from you. I disagree with you most grievously," and he ends it with, "EU, EU, EU, your miserable friend Darwin." So at that point, Wallace really does become, in many ways, according to Ross Slotin's biography of Wallace, a well-titled biography, he becomes a heretic in Darwin's court. They remain cordial. I will say that that Darwin, to his credit, actually always has a high regard for Wallace as a naturalist, as a scientist. And late in life, Darwin actually goes to bat for Wallace and gets him a government pension.
So we have this 10-year period here. Very interesting. I want to break apart a little bit what happens in that 10 years. But before I get there, I want to go back to your earlier point, this idea about competition and how competition occurs and how it affects the evolutionary process seems to be really at the core of what this theory turns into, and particularly what it turns into in this next 10 years that we're talking about. So can you come back and in layman's terms explain the differences between Darwin's view of competition and Wallace's view of competition?
Well, again, you know, Wallace tended to view competition occurring among groups in a demographic sense. Darwin tended to view it as individual competition.
And why is that important? Because, again, we're hitting the note of some themes that come up over and over again. Class, collectivism versus individualism and all that.
Right.
But beyond, so, and I can see where you're drawing, you know, what is really being observed versus what is being reported. But I want to kind of pull that apart a little bit further. What does that mean, competition among groups, and bring it down to a level of, to me, it seems obvious that Wallace was right. I mean, the competition is for the food supply in terms of what would make a certain species go extinct is primarily a group, collective kind of thing. That just seems to ring true to me.
Right. But see, it's an expression of how they collected. Think of how Darwin, remember I said Darwin collected individual species. He would examine them in great, great detail. Maybe just a few different species, whereas Wallace was collecting huge numbers, 125,000 species. He's collecting demographically. And so he's taking a look. You know, the other thing you have to understand about Wallace is he was one of the first to really have an appreciation of zoonomic regions, of biogeography, how it was that certain plants and animals were found in some places, in some zones, and not in others. Darwin didn't have anything in near that level of sophistication. And here's an area where these two different views of how this plays out really has a practical consequence. Wallace knew that domestic animals had a tendency to revert to their original stock if they were placed in a wild environment, or else they would just die, they would perish. But it wouldn't work in reverse. In other words, wild species variation cannot be deduced from domestic practices, which is what Darwin tried to prove in his Origin of the Species.
Go over that one more time, if you will. See if you can simplify it for us a little bit and tie it to Darwin and the dogs kind of thing.
Sure. If you look at Origin of the Species, he has a whole chapter on breeding, domestic breeding examples. And he gives examples of pigeon breeding. He gives examples of dog breeding and horse breeding and that sort of thing. And he says, hey, look, you know, look at these examples of domestic breeding and how we can get these exotic forms of, you know, special breeds of dogs and special breeds of horses and pigeons and so forth.
And he says, great, look, here's evolution in action, right?
It's exactly what he says. And Wallace says, poppycock, that is not evolution in action. He says the very state of selection and then feeding and protecting these newly bred animals effectively shelters them from the effects naturally bearing upon their survival. So that's not natural selection.
And that's so obvious now. When you hear Wallace's argument, it's so obviously true. It doesn't even fit within, really, as we've come to understand Darwinism in terms of this fight for survival. There's no fight, right? There's this controlling entity on top.
Well, he says, if anything, it's unnatural selection. It's artificial selection.
Exactly.
That has no bearing on what we would see in the natural world. So Wallace always, always chided Darwin for that example. He says, you know, those are just bad examples of evolution in action.
And what are the deeper implications for Wallace? How is Wallace's view different in terms of how that really plays out in terms of evolutionary forces in the real world?
Wallace attempts to sharpen the focus on natural selection and how it actually functions and operates in the natural world. However, and here's the key point, here's the important point, he limits it. He limits natural selection in three areas. He says natural selection can explain a lot, but it can't explain everything. And there's three things that it simply cannot explain and shouldn't be relied upon to explain. That is the origin of life, sentience in animals, consciousness, and the mind of man. And that really substantively sketches out the real dividing line between Wallace's evolutionary theory and Darwin's evolutionary theory.
And Mike, it brings us right up to date, right? I mean, it brings us right up to 2011, if you will,
right.
Which is fascinating. It's also very kind of humbling and maybe even a little bit depressing to think that we're still there. And you have some interesting thoughts on that. I read your article, your commentary in Forbes recently from a couple years ago that I think makes that very point that, you know, there's these two different worldviews and we're still stuck arguing these two different worldviews 150 years later.
The irony is the dividing, the things that are dividing us between Wallace's view of evolution, let's say, and Darwin's view of evolution are still with us today. The dividing line is between a materialistic explanation for the natural world or something else. And Wallace is what gives us the something else.
We pound on that so frequently in this show because materialism is just such a silly notion from any angle that you look at it, and we've explored it from many angles of cutting-edge science. It just doesn't make any sense, yet it's still the predominant paradigm, the predominant worldview that we live in. So I hope that anyone listening to this show knows that materialism is kind of a dead-end street. But what I want to bring you back to is the other part of this evolution of the debate, if you will, that you were alluding to about class, about collectivism versus individualism, about capitalism versus communism, if you will. Because in that 10 years, the to a certain extent, those forces really shape this debate too in terms of how this intellectual idea is going to be used. Can you speak to that? And
well, socially speaking, Wallace became a declared socialist in 1890. He actually did not. He was a funny kind of a socialist. He didn't like coerced socialism. He was not a great fan of communism in that sense. But he also was a great proponent of land nationalization. He didn't like the idea of privatized land. He felt that something needed to be done to help the working class, and not enough had been done to do it. And that we lived in a very unequal society that would best be equalized by instituting socialistic principles. Now, that was his view. But interestingly enough, the way this plays out, remember when Wallace is thinking and writing about these things, one of the offshoots of Darwinism is social Darwinism. It is proposed most vehemently and most vocally by Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton. And Francis Galton, in fact, coins the term eugenics. And, I mean, actually, if you think about it, it makes sense from sort of a simplistic standpoint. I mean, everything, there was innumerable things that were wrong with eugenics. But at the time, if you're going to propose a theory of evolution that can be explained by using breeding examples, as Darwin did, then it certainly makes sense that when you're talking about humans, you can give evolution a helping hand, as it were, by sort of guiding it along, by encouraging so-called proper marriages, by discouraging what was considered improper marriage. It's in many ways social engineering of the worst kind, but at the turn of the century, eugenics thought was considered to be cutting-edge science. I mean, it was the thing to do. And in fact, there's a very good book by Harry Bruenius called Better for All the World, which was published a few years ago, which is about the whole eugenics movement in America. There were some 60,000 Americans right. who were sterilized forcibly and sometimes unwittingly. I don't know if you're familiar with that book. It's actually a very good one. But the point was that the leading eugenicists of the day, most of which were dyed-in-the-wool Darwinists, were proposing a rather, in some cases, large-scale program of social engineering to improve humanity. One of the states that had one of the most complete eugenic set of state eugenics laws was California, which had started in 1909.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because we always associate eugenics with Nazi Germany, and anyone who's a student of history knows that they just came and borrowed all that from the...
Well, it was here in America, but Wallace despised the eugenics movement. He called it the meddlesome interference of an arrogant scientific priestcraft. And he had written a whole book called Social Environment and Moral Progress, designed to combat, in large measure, the eugenics movement.
So at this point, then, he already sees the battle lines being drawn in terms of how this idea is going to be used. Is that correct?
I think Wallace came to see the materialistic commitments of Darwinian evolution and increasingly backed away from it and increasingly felt the need to explicate an alternative view of evolution that was shorn of those materialistic commitments. And nowhere does he do that more completely than in his, what I call his grand evolutionary synthesis, The World of Life, which he published in 1910.
Before we run out of time here, we do have to talk about Wallace's encounter with spiritualism. Because, of course, the people who are hardcore materialists really want to latch on that.
Sure.
I'm much more open and welcoming to some of the work that he did, because I think, as the people who are really good students of that know, there's some very good science that was done there, and there was some poor science that was done there, and there was some fraud and all the rest of that that still goes on today. But there were still some observed incidents that we really have no more explanation for today than we did back then. Do you want to address Wallace's encounter with spiritualism?
I'd be happy to, because very often Wallace's detractors will immediately point out, well, after all, Wallace was just a kooky spiritualist, and you know, we can't believe anything he said after his conversion to spiritualism. Well, it's much more complex than that. Let me back up first off and observe something that G.K. Chesterton once said, that a fraudulent seance no more disproves spiritualism than does a fraudulent banknote disprove the Bank of London. What he's trying to say is, yeah, there may be frauds, but that doesn't get to the issue at hand. And there was fraud, there's no doubt about it. But we have to understand that you had a guest on your program a while back by the name of Deborah Blum, I believe, who did a book called Ghost Hunters.
Sure.
And it's a good book. It's an interesting book, and I would encourage any of your listeners to listen to it, to read that book, and to listen to the interview that you did with her. One of the things that book points out, among other things, and I knew this before I read the book, was that in Wallace's day, there were a good number of very, very noteworthy scientists who shared a belief in spiritualism. The chemist and physicist William Crookes, who invented the vacuum tube that bears his name, that was critical in X-ray, believed in it. Lord Rayleigh, pioneer in atmospheric chemistry, who discovered argon gas. He received the 1904 Nobel Prize in Physics. French physician Charles Richet, he was the first to explicate the process of anaphylactic shock. He received the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1913. There's, of course, the famous Harvard philosopher-psychologist William James. A whole host of very, very prominent physicians who wanted a serious and scientific investigation of spiritualism. And in fact, Wallace himself said, "We ask our readers not for belief, but for doubt of their own infallibility on this question. We ask for inquiry and patient experiment before hastily concluding that we are all of us dupes and idiots regards a subject to which we have devoted the best of our faculties and powers."
And let me just interject, because it's something we've talked about on this show. They did investigate it. And we sometimes have an ability to look back at history, even this recent history of 100 years ago, as if, as you're alluding to in Darwin, as if this was a different species, as if their powers of observation weren't the same as ours, as if they couldn't take notes and do simple experiments. The smartest people of their day, I mean, one just has to read William James to see the brilliance of his writing, to think that this guy was a total rube when it came to observing these things is just kind of ludicrous.
And let me point out, there were some mediums that after careful investigation, they simply defied explanation. Daniel Douglas Holm was one of them, and Lenora Piper. Peter Lamont of the University of Edinburgh has written an excellent article on this. It's called Spiritualism in a Mid-Victorian Crisis in Evidence. And he points out that, you know, this wasn't a crisis in faith, it was a crisis in evidence.
Right.
And in the end, what the scientists wound up saying was, well, it's a phenomenon that's all due to subjective experience. And then they just sort of stopped investigating it.
Right. And the reason I don't even go there is because I think the starting point has to be where we were at for this last hour, and that's to look at the underpinnings of how we really wind up still to be stuck in materialism. Because the folks who are really on top of things look no further than quantum mechanics and say, well, quantum mechanics violates materialism right there. And we live and breathe quantum mechanics with our cell phone and our GPS and everything else. So we know that strict materialism doesn't work. So the part that interests me is, how are we stuck in this paradigm? And I think, as you pointed out very early on, it's because Darwinism has become synonymous with science. And science has become synonymous with materialism, and we're kind of stuck in this endless loop. And that's why I think it's interesting to go back and look at, again, how we started, how the world might have been different if these other ideas had been given just a fair treatment in the court of public opinion.
I can tell you one thing. If Wallace's view of evolution had held sway, the definition of science would be the investigation of certain truths in nature. That's it, period. It would not have been methodological naturalism, the idea that you must define the natural world in a materialistic way.
Mike, it's been just a tremendous journey that you've taken us on. Tell us a little bit about what else is going on with you. Any books coming up or anything else we should be on the lookout for?
Well, we do have a website that if your listeners would like to know more about Alfred Russel Wallace, we have an extensive Q&A section on it as well. Just go to www.alfredwallace.org. And it will answer all questions I can imagine you might have about Wallace in much greater detail than we've been able to cover in our limited time. But I certainly appreciate this opportunity to introduce your audience to a person I think has been neglected and misconstrued in the annals of science.
Great. Well, thanks again. It's been great.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks again to Professor Flannery for joining me today on Skeptico. Really, really enjoyed that interview. I love when I enter into a topic that I really don't know much about and am able to benefit from someone who knows so much. As you can tell, I really enjoyed learning all about Alfred Russel Wallace and the world that might have been if his conclusions, really the obviously the correct conclusions, would have been drawn from the theory of evolution. Well, if you'd like more information about this show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. Don't forget the K in there. You'll find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, and a link where you can join others in a discussion about the show on the Skeptico forum. That's going to do it for today. Thanks for staying with me. Until next time, bye for now.